This was my. Okay, I've shown you this, but I must show you these pictures of the relaxation. Okay, this was the plot with Hans Westman. There is a wave function, a two-dimensional box that is evolving as a superposition of 16 modes. It's periodic. We start with initial non-equilibrium system. You see this beautiful relaxation to equilibrium. And the claim is that this kind of relaxation happened in the very early universe. And the idea is that relaxation on expanding space relaxation could be suppressed at long wavelengths. I've just shown you here. I have field theory on expanding space, my flat metric, standard Hamiltonian for free scalar field, and here are. So I've already written down up there. We've got the Schrödinger equation, the continuity equation, the de Broglie velocities, and this is the time evolution of an arbitrary, even non-equilibrium distribution. For the decoupled mode, this was the same equation. So again, if you just have one mode, it's like a two-dimensional oscillator with a time-dependent mass. Okay? And the question is, how does this time dependence of the scale factor affect the relaxation? And I just gave you a sort of crude kind of discussion here. In the short wavelength limit, this will reduce to just a standard oscillator. And we already know you're going to get the same kind of relaxation, while in the long wavelength limit, the evolution of the wave function and of the trajectories tends to freeze. Okay, that's where I was up to, frozen over times of order the Hubble radius. Now, problem. Just looking at a decoupled mode, while this suggests that we should look for non-equilibrium at long wavelength, it doesn't tell us very much because, well, it's just for one decoupled mode in a pure state. Haven't really proved the trajectories are frozen. In principle, if I have a frozen wave function, the trajectories could still be moving around in a way that psi squared is constant. But the biggest problem is that, well, this time scale, the Hubble radius, yes?
Is driven by the phase
of the wave
of the wave
function.
function. When the wave function freezes, it has its real, and therefore the phase freezes. Is that
Well, not really. What I'm saying is, so if I've got psi squared, and the trajectories preserve psi squared in time, if psi squared is static, then it's probably going to be the case that trajectories are static. But it might not be. For instance, if I have a Gaussian wave function, trajectories could be just moving around. None of this matters because I'm now going to do a completely rigorous and general treatment. I'm just saying what I just told you is sort of suggestive, but it doesn't really give you what we want. More severely, because this time scale in a standard cosmology, the Hubble time goes to zero right at the beginning. So the fact that you have freezing over that time scale doesn't really tell us much. Okay. So now we're going to really get down to business. And this is really the new stuff from the last couple of years. Is I want to derive a rigorous condition for non-equilibrium freezing that's valid for an arbitrary time interval, for any quantum state, could be entangled or mixed, and even for interacting fields. Okay? This is let me, because everything I've told you so far is this kind of rough background. I now want to get precise. So let me say again what I'm doing. I'm telling you the quantum theory is just for a special equilibrium state, which probably arose from relaxation in the early universe. And I want to now derive a rigorous condition telling us under what conditions could this relaxation be suppressed. Okay, and I'm going to look in particular, I'm going to start off by looking at a scalar field that is actually free, and it's in a pure quantum state. And I'm going to derive a condition such that over an arbitrary time interval, the relaxation is frozen. And then we're going to show you how the same condition applies to any state, mixed or entangled, or even to interacting fields. And so that is, my key result. If this condition is satisfied, relaxation is suppressed, and that's where we can find these violations of quantum mechanics. And then I'll try to sketch some possible consequences and applications. So here is what I call the inequality for the freezing of quantum non-equilibrium. We've still got this. Sorry, this scalar field on expanding space. it's in a general entangled state, but I'm going to take it to be in a pure state. As you can see, the system is equivalent to a collection of non-interacting one-dimensional harmonic oscillators, okay, with an arbitrary wave function. It could be entangled, and there's the de Broglie velocity field. And here is the equation for the evolution of an arbitrary ensemble. To get a condition for this freezing, I want to examine the behavior of the trajectories, get conditions. Basically, the essential idea is that if the... No talking at the back. No.
No. It's on topic.
What was I saying? Oh, I forget. Right. So the basic idea is this. Look, here's my wave function. This is the equilibrium distribution. If I start out in non-equilibrium, if the trajectories are unable to move far enough in the whole time interval, then in general we won't get relaxation. Think of it as being like I've got my box of gas, the molecules start in a corner. If they were moving, let's say, you know, and I'm talking about a period of 100 years, but the molecules are moving so slowly, in 100 years they can only cover a quarter of the area of the box, the volume of the box, you're not going to get relaxation. Okay? And that is what I'm looking at. You want to look at, so you can get relaxation only if the trajectories move far enough. What we do is you look at the, so we're looking at this time interval. There's a certain displacement for the field mode by, given by integrating over the de Broglie velocity field. You might say, well, a simple condition for freezing is that for every mode, the distance traveled is smaller than the width of the wave packet. But that would be too strong, because I don't need everything. You know, it could be that some of the particles wander far. What I want is that most of the ensemble cannot move by much more than this width of the packet. Okay, and a sort of nice way to capture that is to say, well, if I have if I say most of the trajectory, I want that most of the trajectories don't move by much. And a simple way of defining most, I can define most with respect to the psi squared measure. If you do that, then here's my freezing condition. I want that the equilibrium mean of this, the magnitude of the displacement, is smaller than the width of the packet. That's my condition. Now, let's take that condition. If that's true, then relaxation will be suppressed for that mode. Now we start doing some fiddling. It's sort of tedious, and this is really the core of the whole business, but it's just a bit of fiddling around here. If I take this equilibrium mean of the magnitude of the displacement, I can write it like this in terms of the magnitude, an integral over the magnitude of the de Broglie velocity. Hockey stick. Is this all that was left from the rink they demolished? No. It's so heavy. Anyway, so, okay, so this can then be rewritten, you know, in this form, basically, and here, this step comes from the de Broglie velocity field. You remember that the Q dot is given by 1 over A cubed times the gradient of S, so this the quantity here, there's an A to the 6 here, which shows the equilibrium value of that. This can be written in this form. Here, this operator here is just minus del squared. Okay, it's sort of pretty elementary. A few manipulations that show you, this is basically saying that the mean square of the de Broglie velocity field is less than or equal to the mean square of the quantum momentum with this factor A to the 6, that A cubed is the effective mass, if you like, of this oscillator. It goes on and on, just a little bit of fiddling. Here, there's another inequality I'm using here. The Hamiltonian is a pi squared plus the q squared. That's positive, so I've got this. So I can write this inequality. So this is the equilibrium mean of the magnitude of the displacement is now less than an integral over the time interval of this stuff. Remember here, it's a time dependent. Since the Hamiltonians are time dependent because you've got this A that's a function of time, okay? Right in terms of the number operator, I've got this this mean value of the displacement, which I want to compare with the width of the wave function for that mode at the final time. I want to say if that is less than that width, then I've got non-equilibrium. So we need to look a bit at the width. I've got an expression here using the uncertainty relation, fiddling a bit. It's pretty elementary. I've got an expression that 1 over the width has to be less than this. Okay, I'm basically, because the width is related to the delta pi, which I can express then in terms of less than the root of the pi squared, and that's the mean of the Hamiltonian is the mean of pi squared plus the mean of q squared. It is pretty simple stuff. Anyway, so now I've got, what's that clicking noise? Sorry, it's distracting me. Is there someone? Anyway. So 1 over the width is less than this. The mean of the displacement is less than this. I now have an upper bound for this ratio. Okay, this is the mean displacement. This is the width. That ratio is less than this expression here. Okay, where these the mean of the number here is the mean of the number operating in general a function of time. Okay, it's a time-dependent Hamiltonian. AF is just the value of the scale factor of the finite time. So now here we are. I now define the freezing inequality as the condition that the right-hand side is less than 1. If I set this less than 1, it implies that this is less than 1, and I've got my freezing. Most of these mode amplitudes Q have not moved far enough for relaxation to occur. Okay? So if I set the right-hand side less than 1, here's my freezing inequality. There should be some music now. Ta-da! This is the freezing inequality, okay? My claim is, I've proven to you that if you have modes that satisfy this inequality, if you start off at the initial time with non-equilibrium, then in general, at a later time TF, if this inequality is satisfied, that mode will still be in non-equilibrium. The scale factor, so it's a function of time, it depends on the history of the expansion. The mean number of quanta in the mode is a function of time, it depends on the history of the quantum state. Given the history of the expansion, given the history of the quantum state, you can evaluate this. These are just values at the final time. If this is satisfied, that mode will have frozen non-equilibrium. That was all for a pure state. To do mixed states is almost trivial. If you understand how this theory works with mixed states, it is just a mixture of physically real pilot waves. You will have sub-ensembles sub-ensembles will be guided by a particular wave function. The same thing goes through. The question is, does this, if I look at a particular pure sub-ensemble, is the inequality satisfied? If it is, then for those sub-ensembles, you'll have non-equilibrium. For interacting fields, if I just do a sort of primitive thing with just, say, two different fields, define this scalar field interacting with other fields, but just with a cutoff. So it's just finite, I don't need to worry about divergences. In that model, everything goes through exactly in the same way. The only difference is the time evolution of this n will be different. It will contain a term that depends on the interaction Hamiltonian with the other field. Okay, so it's generally applicable to interacting fields in a mixed state on expanding space. Now, consequences. So the claim is that this is, this is the key to where the lost city of Atlantis that was these waves, it sunk beneath the sea and everything got washed away and everything relaxed to equilibrium and there's no trace left and we're stuck in this awful situation. We can't signal faster than light. The uncertainty principle stops us measuring these trajectories. All of that is just a property of this equilibrium we're stuck in. But we want to do a kind of archaeology and find, is there some trace of this distant era in the distant past where you had this wider physics? The claim is that this is the key to finding it. If this inequality is satisfied, that's where you could get non-equilibrium if there was non-equilibrium to begin with. So now, so if I have an extra 10 minutes, then I can make it. Is it okay? So because now I've got some, okay, one general implication of this, okay? For it to, okay, great. So one general implication. As I've already said, for it to be satisfied, it depends on the history of the expansion and on the time evolution of the quantum state. You can deduce a general sort of result. If I have a radiation-dominated expansion on this time interval I've considered, so the scale factor is proportional to t to the half, then for this to be satisfied, the physical wavelength of the mode at the final time must be larger than the Hubble radius at the final time. Okay? And it's sort of trivial because the mean number of quanta can't be negative. If you use that inequality, you get this result. Now, that does not mean that if the wavelength is bigger than the Hubble radius, you're necessarily going to get suppression. But if you do get suppression, it can only happen for modes larger than the Hubble radius. Now, what there's a whole research project here that needs to be done is to look at a model of a mixed state on expanding space and to work out for which pure sub-ensembles is this freezing inequality satisfied? That will involve detailed calculations of the time evolution of these wave functions, and that has yet to be done. What I have done is a sort of preliminary scouting around, if you like, as kind of to see, well, where could the non-equilibrium be found? It has to be at super Hubble wavelengths. And just from that, we can already start. Sorry, Ravak, I'm just going to continue because. Okay, do you want to ask a quick. Is it quick?
It's quick, yeah. So yeah. From what you said, if we were in a radiation dominated universe, we could only look at modes that were right now greater than our Hubble radius. Is that.
Sure.
But we're in the meta dominated.
So I'm going to be applying this to wavelength. So. If we have some time interval, initial, final,
at the end, if that whole period is radiation dominated, at the end of that period, non-equilibrium can only exist at super Hubble wavelength. And of course, if that was the whole history of the universe, we'd be done for because I'm not going to find, particles or anything. But let me proceed. Okay, possible consequences of this. Okay, let's just take this simple deduction. So it's a necessary but not a sufficient condition that the physical wavelength has to be larger than the Hubble radius. Here I've written in terms of temperature instead of time. So it points to where non-equilibrium could be found. Okay. Now there are two main areas of research in progress. One is corrections to inflationary predictions for the CMB. And one is the possibility that there could exist relic particles today that are in non-equilibrium and violate the laws of quantum mechanics. And here, if I can have 5 minutes for these two things, that'll be, so that's 10 minutes total. Okay? Then it's fine. Okay. Yeah, well, I got to get my own back on Chris Fuchs. He's probably laughing his head off. He pulled the plug on me. So here we are. Corrections to research product, corrections to inflationary predictions for the CMB. Okay? Now, the standard scenario says that I have this fluctuating scalar field that gives rise to curvature perturbations when the wavelength becomes larger than the Hubble radius for that mode. That curvature perturbation is then what generates the temperature anisotropy that we see in the sky. And there are these standard formulas. So here's my scalar field. It generates through this formula, this is just the mean homogeneous part, It generates these curvature perturbations. There's a standard formula, this transfer function just encodes astrophysics. It generates what we're seeing on the sky, right there. There's a direct feed from this to that. So there's a quantum process that generates what we call the angular power spectrum, the mean of the square of these coefficients, this standard kind of plot. This quantity is given in terms of the power spectrum for the curvature perturbations, And there's a prediction to a first approximation in quantum equilibrium. If you do this scalar field theory on an expanding space, the Bunch Davies vacuum, the mean square, the variance of the field is given by this, at least at long wavelengths, and that predicts this famous scale invariant power spectrum. In non-equilibrium, if you think about just thinking about the inflationary era, if you look at the evolution of a scalar field during that time, the Bunch-Davies vacuum is a product of all the modes. So the evolution of each QKR becomes trivial. It's just a one-dimensional wave function. You cannot get relaxation. You just get a scaling as space expands. So what that means is if at the beginning of inflation, if there wasn't a non-equilibrium to begin with, it just stays there. And you have this is going to be a sort of non-equilibrium function, depends on each mode, that will feed into the predicted power spectrum. And you can, so from observations, you can set limits on this function. And I've already looked at that. But what would be more exciting is, can we get a prediction? A prediction. Can we predict something about this function? It's not just, well, there might be non-equilibrium in the inflationary period, so there might be a difference. Let's set limits. Can I predict something? And that's the hard part, but this is some work in progress. Here's the idea. One possible strategy. You could consider an inflationary model that in which there is a pre-inflationary radiation-dominated era. Okay? And the idea is, if I imagine this pre-inflationary era that starts off in non-equilibrium, I let things evolve, I use my inequality to figure out for which modes can I get non-equilibrium left over as we enter the inflationary phase, then we could be in business. Here's what the scenario would have to look like, and it hasn't been worked out yet, but this is the kind of idea. So we know that in the pre-inflationary era, the non-equilibrium can survive only at super Hubble wavelengths. Okay? And in fact, in a radiation-dominated expansion, at sufficiently early times, all modes are outside the Hubble radius. So that's good. But during this era, these super Hubble modes, they because of the way the Hubble radius scales, it's proportional to t, and the space is expanding proportional to t to the half, these modes enter the Hubble radius, and then they can start to relax. Okay, they can enter the Hubble radius and start to relax, and then when inflation begins, these modes are then going to leave the Hubble radius. What's relevant to observation during inflation? Modes that start smaller than the Hubble radius are the ones that then generate the perturbations we see. So there is an essential problem here. For this to work, in the pre-inflationary era, when the modes enter the Hubble radius, they mustn't spend too much time in there. The hope is that they will not completely relax by the time inflation begins, or at least not all of them. And that is more likely to happen for wavelengths that are larger because they enter the Hubble radius later. So if this is looking as if what you could predict is that you're going to get non-equilibrium only above some infrared cutoff, and the aim is to predict that cutoff, and there is in fact some weak evidence from the data, at least according to some people, of a cutoff in the primordial power spectrum. But okay, more exciting and ambitious, I'll go as quick as I can, just a few more slides, is it possible that we could find particles today that are out of equilibrium and that violate the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics? We've said that we have this lower bound for radiation-dominated expansion. Let me... I think something has gone missing. Sorry, hang on. Okay, let's look at... I'm going to forget about inflation. I'll talk a bit about inflation right in the last slide. Let's imagine I just have a sort of what used to be called a standard non-inflationary cosmology with a radiation-dominated expansion and matter domination, okay? And let's ask, could any relic non-equilibrium particles exist coming out of that Big Bang? So we've said that the physical wavelength has to be larger than the Hubble radius at the final time. we don't want wavelengths to get huge. We don't want to be things to be much bigger than we can see. To maximize our chances of detecting something, we want circumstances in which this is as small as we can, or this is as small as we can. Okay. Now, one plausible scenario is to say, let's apply the freezing inequality to a time interval that if I'm, say, focusing on a particular particle species. I mean, consider a time interval up to the time when that particle decouples. Okay? So this TF is as small as I can get it. Plausibly, not necessarily, but plausibly, if non-equilibrium is still present when these particles decouple, they might persist until later on because they're not interacting with anything. And okay, it's a possibility. So if we take this time to be the time of decoupling, what do we have? I have this lower bound now that says, well, for a particular particle species, it decouples at this time, at this temperature, the wavelength has to be bigger than this for non-equilibrium to survive. If we apply that to a radiation-dominated expansion using the sort of usual time-temperature relation, putting in some constants, here's a result. This is a lower bound on the wavelength today at which non-equilibrium could be found for a relic particle that came out of a radiation-dominated phase. There's this big number here that looks worrying. Let's look at some examples. Let's say we start the initial conditions at the Planck era, because remember here, there's the initial temperature here. There's a given time interval, some initial time up to decoupling. If I take initial, just to sort of produce some numbers here, if I imagine starting at the Planck era, for photons that decouple at this temperature, I need to look at wavelengths larger. This is two orders of magnitude larger than our present Hubble radius. I'm never going to... Ridiculous. For neutrinos that decouple earlier, the wavelength would have to be bigger than 100,000 light years. Very, very low energy neutrinos, still hopeless to detect them. Gravitons decouple, of course, at a temperature around the Planck time, but we can't detect relic gravitons. Okay, so that's still hopeless, but there's a ray of hope. The ray of hope, the best candidate I can think of is unstable gravitino. There are, you know, there's supersymmetric theories. It's a partner of the graviton. There are extensively developed scenarios in which gravitinos play an important role in the early universe. What's really good for me is that they decouple very early, okay? So they might be out of equilibrium at some reasonable wavelength, and then later on they decay and produce photons and particles that we can see. And if the parent gravitino is out of equilibrium, there's every reason to think that the decay photons will be. We might be able to see them. Here, let me sort of skip over. I've just sort of given an example of some sort of estimate of the decoupling temperature. The point here is if you take some reasonable numbers here, sort of typical kind of numbers that appear in a lot of models, the wavelength of the gravitino today has to be bigger than 140 centimeters. That's low energy, but possibly accessible. If we imagine there's this sea of relic gravitinos, the low energy part above this, let's say these are decaying, producing decay photons that we observe, and people are searching for this sort of thing, because gravitinos are a candidate for dark matter. People are looking for decays of this dark matter. There are even reports saying that they found this sort of thing. The photo, imagine we find, finally, dark matter decay, it's gravitinos, we've got these photons decaying. There's a spectrum of these photons. What the prediction would be that above a certain wavelength, possibly of this order, these photons are going to behave in strange ways. If you do something like pass the photon through a polarizer and then pass it through a second polarizer, the probability of going through the second polarizer will not go as the cos squared of the angle. That's a basic quantum non-equilibrium prediction. So that's the sort of thing that would be wonderful. And just finally, my very last slide, some people will say, well, that's all very well, but if inflation did occur, then, you know, the relic density of those sort of particles will be reduced effectively to zero, and there's no chance of seeing this at all. Even in an inflationary scenario, there's a possibility here that we know that in inflationary scenario, you know, what happens before gets smoothed out and exponentially diluted. But in an inflationary scenario, the matter and radiation we see all arose from the decay of the inflaton field. Now, so if the inflaton field is in non-equilibrium, at least for some of its modes, then it can be that the particles that are created by the perturbative decay of the inflaton could be out of equilibrium. There are various issues here. For us to see the non-equilibrium of those particles, we would want them to be created at a temperature that is below their decoupling temperature. Otherwise, as soon as they're created, they're going to interact with things in the relaxed equilibrium. I think there are some scenarios where this looks plausible. There are scenarios where gravitinos are copiously produced by inflaton decay. Again, it's gravitinos. I like these particles. There are theories where gravitinos are a significant component of dark matter. And as I said, what we're after is the decay photons and the possibility that those photons would violate Mahler's law above a certain critical wavelength, which the key, of course, would be to predict precisely that wavelength. I don't have a precise prediction. I can tell you that the wavelength has to be above a certain number, but to get a more detailed prediction requires that we study in more detail, you know, for a model of the early universe, we're looking at a mixed state, we're looking at this mixture of wave functions. We want to see for which sub-ensembles is this freezing inequality satisfied. And if we do find this non-equilibrium, then of course we'll finally be out of this. Do I still have my picture? No, I haven't. We'll be out of this small, oh, there we have it. Out of this, we're stuck in here, and you know we would be at last escaping from this little quantum region that we're stuck in. That's all. Thank you very much.
In the spirit of Perimeter Institute, we have a prediction of an experiment that could check invariable theory simultaneously with superselectric dark matter. And thank you very much. I think we're just a few minutes older, so what I'll do is I'll take two questions from non-experts. So first, the science students. Anybody has any questions? I know there are a lot of experts and friends of Anthony here, but we know how to get him in the bar and give him a hard time. So I want to just take two quick questions from students. Yes,
oh, yeah. So I guess this is a bit off topic, but is there any indication of how you say this Bohmian theory would be Lorentz non-invariant?
Yeah.
Is there any indication of how Lorentz invariant or approximate Lorentz invariant would arise from it?
Right, so basically it's pretty simple. If you say take a theory like the one I've been describing, where you have a scalar field in space, that theory, I didn't have time to really emphasize, it is defined with respect to a preferred frame. There's a T here. Okay, I've taken a particular slicing of space-time. Even in curved space-time, I can take, if it's globally hyperbolic, there's a slicing, I can assume there's one definite slicing. Out of equilibrium, you can signal non-locally, and you can see the slicing. Okay? Fine, that's the fundamental theory. When you're in equilibrium, as we are, then it turns out that you can't really see the details of these trajectories. All what you measure, everything you measure, you're just looking at the statistics of the psi-squared distribution. Okay? And to get those statistics, all you need is this Schrödinger equation. Okay? Now this Schrödinger equation, you can rewrite in the Heisenberg picture. It's equivalent to having a field operator that obeys standard wave equation. It, you know, at the statistical level, it looks Lorentz invariant, provided the Hamiltonian here has the right kind of structure. What basically happens here is that Lorentz invariance is an emergent symmetry of the equilibrium state. And to get the right emergent symmetry, you have to have the right, the Hamiltonian that obeys the right kind of relations. So, is that right?
Okay, there was one more question, I think, here. Somewhere, one of the guys here, yes.
I was curious, so you talk a lot about how the universe now is in the equilibrium state, and it's the simulations you did show that if you do start with a non-equilibrium state, it very quickly converges to the equilibrium state. And we know that the Schrodinger equation that governs evolution preserves the size squared measure.
Right.
Is it possible that there are other measures that are not the normal size squared one that are also preserved on the Schrodinger equation, so it wouldn't decay and it would stay there, and so you'd be able to see that?
Right. So there is a theorem, Ward Stoyer here showed, that I think is that if you look at measures that are constructed, what is it, local functionals of the psi field, then there is actually only one measure that's preserved in time, and it's the psi squared measure. If I can add something, I thought you were going to ask, because I hope someone would ask this, let me pretend you asked it, is there a way, once we're stuck in this psi squared state, to knock things out of equilibrium? That would be nice. Can I, in the lab, hit something harder to create this quantum non-equilibrium? So according to the theory we have, this kind of theory, you can't. If you look at it, once you're stuck in psi squared, you're just stuck. But I do have a speculation that if you include gravity in the picture, and in particular the formation and evaporation of a black hole, might that the radiated particles might be in a state of quantum non-equilibrium. And there are two sort of intuitions there. One is that, the Hawking information loss problem. If the outgoing state is in non-equilibrium, it can contain more information than normal. The other nice thing is that if you look at black hole evaporation, you've got these ingoing and outgoing field modes that are entangled. You can show in this theory that if I have entangled systems, if in the black hole and the singularity there's some weird non-equilibrium because of some weird theory that maybe Lee has cooked up, okay, when this system interacts with that non-equilibrium, via the entanglement, the system outside the hole will get knocked out of equilibrium. In other words, its non-equilibrium can propagate through an entangled state. So there's a mechanism by which, you know, the outgoing Hawking radiation could be out of equilibrium if there's something crazy happening. If at the LHC, if they do produce these microscopic black holes, which some people think they will, this TV gravity, then I'm going to be the first one who wants to test quantum mechanics for the decay problems, because they might be, if there is such a process. The only plausible way I can think of in which you might create non-equilibrium out of a prior equilibrium state.
Very good. Thank you. On that note, thank you very much. And if people want to stay around and chat with Anthony, Anthony is still here for the rest of the week. And thank you for a very good time.